Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zeslovsky. You know, if ever there was a time to drop a contextual Ice Ice Baby lyric on you, it's now. So stop, collaborate, and listen. This is episode number 51. Greetings, my friend. I am so grateful you've joined me for an episode of Smart and Simple Matters. This one comes on the heels of last episode where I recapped the first 49 jam sessions of this podcast. I felt a lot of love since publishing episode 50, and I've been feeling the love in other ways too. I want to give a shout out to an iTunes reviewer by the handle I or Mom for her recent review of the show. The title of her review is Seeds of Awesomeness Found Here. And she wrote, I love the variety of interviews and topics discussed. Keep it up, Joel. That's it. Just two short sentences. Nothing fancy or formal. And my passion for bringing you new podcasts is renewed. Awesome stuff. Now, let's dive into the heart of this episode with Lauren Anderson. As you'll hear in a moment, Lauren's a total collaborative consumption pro and created a list of resources for you as meaningful as you have time for. Now, she and I spoke about how to be unshackled from impulses to accumulate possessions, what a shareable city is, why the drive to share is only growing stronger, and get this one, how to build trust for strangers to exchange chainsaws. That last one will make sense soon. Now, I'm not going to delay you getting to the good stuff. So here we go. Welcome, Smart and Simple Matters listeners. Right now, just for you, I have Lauren Anderson with me, ready to talk about, well, a whole host of pretty groovy stuff. Lauren hangs out in Sydney, Australia with her husband. That is, when she's not on a train or plane to get the world excited about and engaged in collaborative consumption. She is the Chief Knowledge Officer at Collaborative Lab and a dynamic speaker and workshop leader at events like TEDx or the UN Environment Program. And when she's not helping the organizations that operate the collaborative consumption landscape, she's working on helping women become better leaders. You will also find her giving office hours at Levo.com or on her hobby blog, The Lovely, which profiles an inspiring woman every weekday. Welcome to Smart and Simple Matters, Lauren.
Thanks so much, Joel. Great to be here.
Let's start where we always start, which is with what I call the seeds of awesomeness. If you could explain for people so they start to get a sense of where you've come from and why you are who you are today, could you describe maybe one or two things about your environment growing up or maybe some kind of pivotal experience that helps us better understand who you are?
Oh, I love that question. I think I do spend a lot of time thinking about this because it's always, you know, it's that quote around things only make sense when you join the dots looking backwards. You know, it's really hard to tell how all of these experiences are going to add up. And I think for me, something that was nurtured and instilled in me by my parents at a very young age was a real thirst for learning in the most positive sense. I was exposed to lots of cool ideas and really taught how to you know, read and write and all those things from an early age, which I think has really actually formed a lot of my interests over time. I went to some fantastic schools that really nurtured that in me and was really fortunate in that regard because I think some people don't necessarily find school to be that kind of nurturing environment. But for me, what came out of that was a real sense that I could pursue the path that was most interesting to me rather than feeling that I needed to conform to what, you know, society's idea of success looks like, you know, to become a doctor or a lawyer or a nurse. There was no pressure on me to follow that particular path, which ended up having me study things like drama and journalism and creative writing. But I have to admit, when I finished university, I was sort of looking at what I'd accumulated and wondering exactly what it did add up to. But I was fortunate again that a lecturer that had taught me through my course offered me one of my very first jobs out of university. And that was in a leadership and team building training team for corporates or for organizations who are looking to bring, you know, emotional intelligence and leadership skills into their organization. So as a formative experience, that was pretty incredible. But over the last, I guess, decade or so, my interests have really narrowed into, you know, not business as usual, but questioning what the point of business is to really contribute to society. And that's when I came across the concept of social innovation and social enterprise, business that was inherently about adding value to society over having a profit motive. And unfortunately, I don't think enough businesses today are really run like that, even though that is probably the core reason for a business to exist. So I got deeper involved into the community that was growing around that idea in Sydney. And then I was lucky enough through some of those experiences to meet a woman named Rachel Botsman, who was in the final throes of writing her book, What's Mine is Yours, The Rise of Collaborative Consumption. And she kind of explained this concept to me about, you know, why car sharing and eBay is connected and this cool new idea called Airbnb, where people were staying with each other rather than staying in hotels. And that, you know, it just clicked another light bulb on in my head, which I saw these businesses as that next layer of business that was set to fulfill a purpose rather than to make money. And of course, had this a multiplier effect of other people benefiting from this ecosystem. So I stayed in touch with Rachel, and 4 years later, we've been growing the collaborative consumption movement around the world.
Yeah, you have. Holy smokes. I've been paying attention to the two of you and just collaborative consumption, which I'll need to ask you at some point in time. I've heard synonyms like the share economy. And of course, people haven't heard of these things before. Or maybe you and I, we might abbreviate and call it call cons, C-O-L-L-C-O-N-S, which is the hashtag that people use on Twitter and other things. Just an FYI for our listeners in case they hear us throwing around some acronyms. We're like, wait a second. People didn't describe what call cons is for us.
Yes.
Okay. You did a fantastic job of connecting the dots backward, as you said. But I'd like to go back for a point in time. You were talking about the purpose of business, which of course businesses serve a greater economy. So from your perspective, if the purpose of business is to do some kind of good, whether that's social good or environmental good, you know, whatever that may look like, from a greater economy perspective, can you tell me what's an economy for?
Yeah, I this is something that I think about a lot. And, you know, we've actually started talking more broadly about the collaborative economy, you know, beyond just consumption. What other things are happening now that are actually having this much more big economic shift? For me, the economy is to keep things, you know, keep things in motion and ensure that there's efficiency and people have access to the things that they need. It's not this idea of growth, like continued growth. You know, I was reading a fantastic article this morning just about this scary notion that if we continue to sustain growth as it is now, we just have absolutely no chance of improving our world and certainly heading towards an inevitable outcome that isn't going to be pleasant. So I think the economy has come to represent growth, whereas in fact it's this balance between supply and demand and keeping things at a place where everyone can access what they need.
Okay, well, I know other people like Donnie McClurkin, for example, of the Post Growth Institute, and there you go, right in the name itself, post growth. So a lot of people see us or want us, and when I say us, I mean the entire world, to be in a post growth era where it's not about growing anymore. Not that anybody wants to intentionally contract, but what does the world look like in a more sustainable environment where the purpose of business and of the economy isn't to just continue to grow? We're beyond that now. What's next? Mm-hmm. And that kind of gets in, at least from my perspective, the story of collaborative consumption. And a lot of what I see here is alternative forms of growth, maybe not necessarily post-growth. People like to think of it in terms of saving money or making money. Like, I can find a neighbor to drive me where I want to go for half the price of a taxi. That's pretty sweet, right? Or I can rent out my clothing for a day to someone who needs, I don't know, like a unique electric blue prom dress. That's pretty awesome. But my understanding is you see the story a little bit differently, especially from the inside. And maybe can you tell us a little bit about the narrative of, well, you already mentioned this a little bit, social entrepreneurship that's going on?
No, you raised some really interesting points. And I think that the narrative has been obscured, especially recently, around the Silicon Valley-esque nature of a lot of these companies, and growth is still actually a huge part of their narrative. Whereas for me, collaborative consumption and the part that really got me excited all those years ago was this idea of there is enough in the world, it's just not distributed well, and we don't have the tools to allow us to access things we need. So with the advent of all these technologies we now have, from mobile phone technology to, you know, GPS tracking to, you know, the social networks that connect us, we had this huge opportunity to really rethink how we go about buying the things we need or accessing the things we need. But I guess instead, and also through that, to be able to empower people to live differently, to be unshackled from this idea of needing to accumulate possessions, but instead having experiences and being able to tap into those experiences. I think what's probably happened is, you know, when new markets have been created, suddenly the point isn't to match demand with new supply, it's actually to create a whole other kind of supply, and driving the market in a different direction. So I really like the examples that tap into unused capacity that is actually a problem or an inefficiency in the market, and matching that with something that's actually a real need, rather than finding everything in our lives that could make a buck for us and leveraging them to their full potential. That seems like an abstraction of the idea in the first place.
Can you give us a couple of examples? You mentioned empowering people to live differently. How do you see that actually happening right now?
So, for example, things like, you know, if we used TaskRabbit as an example, or, you know, Skill sharing platform or a task marketplace, I think the inherent idea here is to be able to give people other ways to earn income, that could be secondary income, or it could actually be a primary source of income that is otherwise unattainable because the flexibility isn't there in our current labor market. You know, we either have full-time jobs or part-time jobs, not jobs that you can dip in and out of and choose when it suits you to do them. So I see that as tapping into the idle time and the idle skills of a whole bunch of people who have otherwise been ruled out of having meaningful work. And I do see that as a real opportunity to think differently, especially as we shift towards more of a freelance type economy. Now, a lot of the critics will point out the problems with that around protection for people who are working. You know, that's absent when you're doing this yourself. But if we start to rethink the whole system, I think we can also rethink a lot of those problems and the basic protections that every human should have, whether or not they're employed by a big company or not.
Yeah, this is almost a separate conversation, but reputation and trust, which are built into a lot of collaborative consumption platforms that I'm familiar with. And you mentioned a couple, TaskRabbit and Skillshare. Mm. Now, some people might be nodding their heads like, oh yeah, I used TaskRabbit yesterday and it was awesome. I got somebody to go and run this errand and bring it to me in 30 minutes and it was fantastic. Other people might say, Task what? Task who? TaskRabbit? Yep. Is that a what? And the thing that I've noticed is that the face of the share economy, it looks different from city to city and from country to country. I mean, I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, here in the United States, and you know, San Francisco and New York City, they seem to get all the cool startup services years before I do, and years before you probably see them in Sydney, Australia. So there's things like Airbnb, which is starting to get like almost a household name, but you're not going to see that for years and years, depending on where you are. So what resources do you have available to tell me what services I have access to and how mature they are?
Good question. So this is a bit of a work in progress for us. We have the Collaborative Consumption Directory, which is on our site, and it's a catalog of more than 1,000 examples of these kinds of businesses all around the world. And you can currently filter them by country, but what we're working on right now is really to look at that, as you said, the hyperlocal or the city level application, so that you could see you're in Minneapolis, you can use, is it Nice Ride, the bike sharing program? In Mini?
Yeah, we have Relay Rides, we have Nice Rides, we have lots of different. Bicycling is really big in the Twin Cities, so we have a few.
Exactly. So what we're working on right now is how to enable this directory to actually have hyperlocal applications where people can see which services are available right there for them to use. And that's going to be something that we're working on over the next few months. But currently, you can definitely look at countrywide applications. And I think a lot of the companies that exist are doing their best to make their services available nationally, though, with the likes of peer-to-peer car sharing, where you're renting somebody else's car, like relay rides. Sometimes they are, or Lyft, for example, where you can get a ride with somebody. They're really rolling out city by city, so it might take a little bit longer for those.
Man, I can already tell the show notes for this episode are going to be huge with the companies and the resources that you're rattling off, which is great. I want people to dig in. And if they're not familiar with collaborative consumption, I really want them, because the first time I found out about it, I was just blown away.
Yep.
Maybe you can comment a little bit more, though. You talked about country or where we live, which is a major factor in terms of what's available to us and what we can actually do on the practical level with collaborative consumption, other than just supporting the spirit of sharing and realizing, hey, we don't all need to own a chainsaw. I might use it once every other decade, but if I need one, I don't need to have it in the garage. Are there other major factors besides where I live that are going to determine what I can do with collaborative consumption?
And actually, I might even correct myself there, because I think the problem right now is that people assume that we need these big platforms and technology companies to actually enable this. And in fact, a lot of these things could be facilitated through a local Facebook community group, or within a network that already exists, like a school or a church. Technology is a factor in making it frictionless, but it doesn't have to be a whiz-bang app that is globally or nationally connected. It really is about what's available in your local area, or what you can offer to people in your local area. So I would encourage everybody to think bigger about how they might start something like this in their own community. Of course, the big platforms make it more efficient, but that's not to say it's not possible. But to your question just now, I think it really does need this idea of critical mass, which is where you have enough of the thing that people are looking for, or on the other hand, there are enough people to use the things that you have, because otherwise the kind of the purpose, or that the value of doing something like this actually reduces when it's more difficult than just going to the shops to buy something. So I think this notion of critical mass is really important, and it's something that we advise companies or entrepreneurs to really focus on one specific vertical or one specific idea, whether that's cars or whether that's tools or sports equipment, because it really gives a focus to what people think that they can contribute, and also that people will know what they're going to get when they go to a particular platform or website. So that's really key. And the other thing, which you kind of alluded to before, is this idea of building trust. You know, how do we build trust between other people who are otherwise strangers? And the nice thing about neighborhood platforms is that there is actually a known community. And what you're doing is actually creating new tools to reduce the friction between asking your neighbor for something. You know, where knocking on your door might seem like a bit of an invasion of privacy, or it might happen at an inconvenient time. A little message on Facebook to say, I'd love to borrow your chainsaw, when can I pick it up? Is a much less frictionless way. It's a more frictionless way of doing these things.
Well, I like what you're saying. So asking is one thing, but even knowing that somebody has something that you can ask for, that's where the 21st century technology component comes in. Because you're right, people have been resourceful ever since humans have existed. They have shared and not needed, everybody doesn't need to own one or more of the same thing. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, hey, if you want to exchange something and it doesn't exist in your area, use the tools that you already have, social media, knocking on people's doors. But again, that's where, you know, the exchange of, it's not just goods and services, but it's also the transfer of trust from one person to another, especially with strangers, which is such a key part of it. And that's a really cool component of what I see as the share economy. But there's lots of, I know for a lot of people aren't familiar with this landscape like you are, or that I'm starting to become in. And if they want to get into it, at least initially, are there some kind of online forums or events or podcasts that you would recommend people check out?
Yeah, I think there's some really great resources out there. I think there's a magazine, an online blog called shareable.net, which does a really great job of really talking about all of the different possibilities and certainly at a community level, how people can start to engage in the collaborative consumption or in the sharing economy. So, you know, how to start a local food swap, how to run a garage sale. There are lots of cool ideas that they talk about.
And how to create one in a local neighborhood. Exactly. Shareable.net's awesome. Okay, sorry. I got excited because you mentioned it. And I love them too. Keep going.
Yeah, no, they do a great job. And I think, you know, our directory certainly is a great place to explore specific companies that might already exist in your country, or if you're looking for all of the wide possibility of ideas, you know, from electronics to tools to skills to what are the full gamut of applications in this space. Certainly, that's a good place to start.
Hang on, stop there for a second. When you say R, who do you mean? Are you talking about perhaps
our collaborativeconsumption.com directory?
Okay.
Talking about.
Which is separate from this team of global curators that you have at collaborativeconsumption.com. Am I right?
It is separate but connected, because our curators will also share with us and they will add examples to this directory, which helps us maintain this international viewpoint around collaborative consumption. So our global curators, yes, are based in 30 different regions around the world, different cities, and they're really helping us to keep tabs on the new activity in their region, some of the unique challenges that city or that country might be having, and also helping us to profile those local entrepreneurs on a global stage so we can see the rich tapestry of entrepreneurs and passionate people who are making a play in this space as well.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to make sure that you had the opportunity to mention your team of global curators because they do awesome stuff. And of course, for people who are regular listeners of the show, they know that I kind of geek out about everything curating.
They're a huge part of our global radar, and they are also running fantastic programs and initiatives in their own city of their own accord. So a wonderful team. Absolutely. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I'm kind of curious. Well, I'm curious about a lot of things, and I'm not going to ask you about every single thing today, but everything that we've mentioned so far seems to be mostly physical in nature, except for maybe the exception of skills, because skills are something that you can record a video or audio or whatever it is and transfer that digitally very easily. But from my perspective, the emphasis on collaborative consumption so far has been on cars, on spare bedrooms, on chainsaws, and that kind of stuff. Are you seeing any of these nascent forces channeling their energy into letting me share digital stuff, like maybe books or software?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about the sharing of digital goods, funnily enough, is it's actually become harder or more fraught to share them than it has been to start sharing our physical stuff, which seems counterintuitive, obviously, because, you know, something digital has a very easy way of being transferred, whereas giving somebody a chainsaw or a drill is actually much harder. But what's happening, I think, you know, with the way the media industry has been challenged by the advent of digital, we've seen a lot of resistance with the sharing of ebooks, for example, but we've started to just more recently see some good programs, lending library type solutions being developed. I think Amazon has got ebook rental options now, but this idea of renting or sharing the digital goods actually hasn't exploded as much as the physical side of things. And perhaps it's also because the perceived expense or hassle of having digital assets hasn't been as much of a pain point as has having a library full of books in your own home. So perhaps that's why as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there's a lot of challenges, and you're right. It seems counterintuitive with how easy it is to move and transfer digital things. I'm wondering, is there something specific that you see, but is there one huge challenge that you and Rachel and other folks are working to make a big dent in that you feel is really preventing collaborative consumption from reaching that critical mass that you and I hope it will find?
Yes, for us, there's two key components, and it's not necessarily a challenge so much as a huge area needing investment and further exploration. And for me, that is the existing companies, the incumbents who are currently leading the economy, driving the economy, and then on the other side, the government and policymakers, which also have a huge role to play in enabling this space. So a lot of the work we're doing now is to help company, you know, a lot of the things that we talk about when we travel and do presentations is how do existing companies see this not as a threat, but as a real opportunity to get involved and to reconsider their business model and look for new and more efficient ways of offering their products or services, or perhaps, you know, switching from products to services is another key example. And I think until we have some of those bigger companies really making a huge play in the space, it won't have the legitimacy that it needs. But having said that, we're already seeing, especially in the mobility space, in the car space, car manufacturers like BMW and Daimler actually launching their own car sharing programs, recognizing that behaviors around car ownership are actually changing.
No kidding.
Yeah. So Car2Go has, Daimler has launched Car2Go, which is operating in a number of US cities, including Austin in Texas. And gosh, I can't think off the top of my head which other cities, but there are a number of them.
That's okay. We'll send them to the website. Yeah. They'll look in the show notes, they'll click on the link and they'll say, ooh, they're there, huh?
And they're great little smart cars as well. So it's just changing the landscape of urban mobility. But on the government side of things as well, you know, we've seen a huge role that cities will need to play in enabling these things. And already a lot of cities around the world are you know, making efforts to understand this new kind of behavior and to consider the needs of these new stakeholders alongside their existing ones, which is never easy, but it's critical. So, you know, the idea of a shareable city is something that we're really advocating for and starting to see places like Paris and Amsterdam, San Francisco, obviously, and even Seoul in South Korea really coming on board with this concept.
This concept of a shareable city, what is that?
So we're looking at how do collaborative consumption ideas actually integrate into the landscape of a city? So how is shared private transportation as opposed to shared public transportation become a huge part of the solution? How are we looking at the resources that we have in the city? You know, the city is a perfect landscape for this, and a lot of things that cities provide could already be considered as part of this. So, you know, the idea of a library is basically a shared asset that people can access different books all the time. So how do we integrate some of these other platforms like, you know, the accommodation aspect with Airbnb or, you know, even the services where people are actually able to do these micro jobs as part of a bigger citywide employment program. So thinking more laterally about the services that they also use. So cities, you know, as we can see, have a huge number of opportunities for how to get involved in this, whether that's looking at their own services internally and how they can tap into more collaborative consumption services to run the city, but also how they can integrate these new ideas into their own offerings, the public services that they provide that could actually be tapping into the resources of the community rather than being a whole new public service that they need to create.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to tapping into things that are untapped, that have a lot of potential, I know, I'd like to transition just a little bit. Collaborative consumption fascinates the heck out of me. I love it. But that's not what you personally are all about. You have other interests and other passions. And when I think about things that are untapped, I think about, I'm a man, and I've had a lot of privileges. I've had a lot of experiences because I'm a man. But when you talk about the status quo, existing companies and the incumbents, you know, government and policymakers, for the most part around the world, these are all men. And you're really big into empowering women to take on leadership roles across organizations, whether they're governmental or corporate or nonprofit, and help get acceptance from society that, you know what, hey, maybe, just maybe, a woman is actually the best person for a job a lot of the time. Have you found that it's easier for a woman to make a dent in the social entrepreneur universe, say, compared to a lot of the more traditional status quo businesses?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I don't have any statistics necessarily to say unequivocally, but I think there are at least as many women entrepreneurs in the collaborative consumption space as men. And if you look at the typical tech breakdown, for example, that's certainly not the case. We'd be talking more like 10 to 20%. So I think it's the concept of collaborative consumption that has really attracted a lot of women to realize that they can be entrepreneurs and they can be social entrepreneurs, because it's about addressing that need and that having that purpose-driven aspect to the organization that is actually bringing them bringing them forward. You know, we've seen women realizing that baby clothes are a bit of a waste if you don't get to pass them on effectively to somebody who's going to use them. So there's a huge number of women and mothers who've actually started innovating around the idling capacity of baby goods. And that's been a really fascinating area. But more than that, in terms of the social entrepreneurship space broadly, I do think it's something that women have an innate understanding of and attraction to, because you can see the bigger picture and not just be motivated by the financial reward. I think, you know, more often than not, women don't have that same level of drive and incentive around making money for money's sake. So I'm really excited to see how that actually shifts the landscape. But I also think that there are some systemic problems, no matter what industry we're talking about, and those also need to be addressed. But as I mentioned before, with the likes of, you know, a task marketplace like TaskRabbit, there are new opportunities for women to start exercising their skills even when they're time constrained, or maintaining a connection to the workforce when they're otherwise having had to take leave. I came across a really cool concept the other day called a returnship, which is something that apparently I think Deloitte might have pioneered a number of years ago. But it's this idea of having a much more structured program for women who are returning to the workforce, or actually for anyone returning to the workforce after leave. But obviously that's more often than not women who've finished their child caring stint and needing to return to work. So initiatives like that, where you're seeing much more of an active role in the re-education and the support process that goes along with that, I think those things are absolutely critical in continuing this growth towards a more equal status in the workplace.
Returnship, huh? Well, I'll tell you what, when I was still working my corporate job and I had my first son, I took paid time off, but there certainly wasn't anything like a returnship, at least in the United States. Paternity leave still doesn't really exist, and our maternity leave policies are horrendous relative to pretty much the entire rest of the world in any kind of category that you have. One thing that I'm curious about, though, is you're talking about both the spirit and the level of acceptance of women in collaborative consumption and being social entrepreneurs. Do you see ways for us, you, me, and people who are listening, and anyone who's interested, to push that outside of the sphere that it's currently living in?
It's a good question. I think it actually has to come from women themselves, and that really is about support of each other. And I guess it's one of the motivations behind why I started my little blog, The Lovely. It was really the fact that if I sat down and thought about all of the incredible women that I know doing quite incredible things, or maybe I don't know them, but they're, you know, doing things in other parts of the world, the level of recognition that they get, or the publicity for the work that they're doing, is often much less sufficient than it should be. And I'm not necessarily comparing it to whether a man in the same role would have more acknowledgement, but I think it's that recognition and the ability to point to people doing similar things, and to have that peer support, even if it's not that you know them directly, but you can see that somebody else out there is doing something that you would see yourself doing, and that validation really goes a long way. And I do think that, you know, with the history of men in the workforce, there is many more, there's much more peer support at that level, and much more of a self-belief that, yes, you can do that. But women don't necessarily, they've probably only got a few decades of that kind of thing to draw from. And the model is changing all the time with the flexibility of the work environment. You know, people having children earlier or later, all of those things really influence what they need to get going themselves. But certainly for me, that recognition of the cool stuff that's happening, and that connection of peers is critical.
Yeah, well, I think there's two parts to it. One is peer support. And support takes the form of empathy or encouragement, and sometimes it's very emotional, where there's also peer development, which is active, and it's growth-oriented as opposed to acceptance-oriented. So I see a lot of peer support, but what I'm not seeing a lot of is peer development. And I'm in a peer development group something called, we call it the weekly ask, where mm-hmm. it's mostly women, but 15 minutes every single week. There's a Google Plus community, and we have the opportunity to ask people to spend up to 15 minutes of their time helping us develop on a challenge that we have or a struggle, whether it's a blog post that we're trying to write or a sticky business problem. Maybe we're having some existential crisis, and we need that peer support right there.
Yeah.
I'd love to see more platforms, whether they're informal like I have, or maybe a little bit more structured, where both women and men can get the kind of peer development that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we're talking about these new kinds of business models or things that are quite world-changing that don't have a conventional pathway, that's exactly where this kind of peer development is needed, because it can be very easy to feel like you're the only one or you're crazy and you're wasting your time. And that development aspect is really where you can push through some of those more gritty moments.
Yeah. Well, I am a little bit crazy, to be honest, and I know you weren't calling me that, but in a good way, in a healthy way. Sometimes you got to get a little bit nutty and bold and audacious and do things that aren't expected or that are unconventional, countercultural. The share economy is like that too. Initially, people thought, "That's crazy. What? I'm going to engage in commerce with a complete and total stranger? Are you kidding me?" And you look at how far we've come in such a short period of time, where this is so commonplace. I'm encouraged by how quickly these days crazy ideas can become not just mainstream ideas, but forces for good in a lot of different ways. All right, I'm going to ask you one more question, and I almost hesitate to ask this because then I'm probably going to want to ask you 10 more questions. but I always ask this one. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you would like people to know?
Ooh, I think the thing that really, and it possibly is more from an Australian experience, but I often find people still too unprepared to make a change in the way they're living. You know, this collaborative consumption for me isn't just about cool business models. It's about actually fundamentally rethinking the economy, as we talked about before. But I still find, you know, the fear of trying something for the first time obviously is valid, but to write off new ideas because it seems crazy is possibly the biggest challenge that we come up against. So, you know, for people to be thinking differently about what's possible, and then to actually be able to take action around those things to push that even further, I think is critical.
Yeah, everything's impossible until the first person does it and proves everyone who came before them wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that I'd love to see more people, and, you know, young people, old people, this isn't a Generation Y millennial movement. This is something that does span the generations, but it is also going to require everybody's participation to really become the thing that it should be.
Absolutely. You know what I'd like to see?
What?
I would like to see people go hunting for your best stuff online and dig into what you represent personally, but also all of the good that you're doing through the businesses mm-hmm. that you're involved in. Where can folks mm-hmm. find you online?
You can find me at collaborativeconsumption.com mostly. You can find me on Twitter at @L_Anderson. I also have my blog, thelove.ly.
Okay. I will have links to all of those in the show notes, and I'm going to heavily encourage people, not just right now, but also when I do a little bit of post-production in a second, to check all of those different places out. I'm really excited about all the tools and resources that you threw out there. Lauren, thanks a ton for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Joel.
That Lauren, wow, she really hit it on the head with her views on the economy, what it's for, and who it should be serving. That's us, you and me. You know, this whole collaborative consumption / share economy thing has been going on for eons, and we're finally able to efficiently exchange trust, goods, products, and services with the help of technology. Yes, technology can enslave us, but it can also empower us. And in this case, it is our friend. To find out what you can exchange, go to collaborativeconsumption.com/directory. And see how you can be more active with your idle time, skills, and resources. If you see something missing in that directory, tweet Lauren at @L_Anderson. Let her know what's up. I put the Collaborative Consumption directory link, Lauren's Twitter profile, and all the other resources we spoke about in the show notes for this episode. You can get that grooviness at valueofsimple.com/SASM051. If you'd like to hear my pal Saul of Hearts talk about the share economy, come to Simple Rev in Minneapolis, Minnesota on October 3rd and 4th, 2014. Saul's giving a workshop titled How to Use the Share Economy to Reduce Consumption, Build Community, and Earn Some Extra Cash. It is going to be a great one. Other folks like Joshua Becker, Mike Vardy, and equally amazing people you've probably never heard of before will be leading workshops as well. To snag your ticket for Simple Rev 2014 and see us all there, go to simplerev.com/tickets. Now, if you want to see me before Simple Rev on October 3rd and 4th, I'll be hanging out in Portland, Oregon from July 10th through the 14th for the World Domination Summit. I attended WDS last year, and it was one of the top 10 experiences of my life. So you can imagine my excitement and gratitude for having a chance to go back and experience the magic once again. Are you going to be in Portland at the same time as me? Let's coordinate a chat. If so, email me via joel@valuesimple.com. Send a tweet at my Twitter handle, which is @JoelZeslowski. Or you can get social on Google Plus with me, where I'm @+JoelZeslowski. You can connect with me for reasons other than WDS, of course, and I encourage you to do so. Just say what up. Tell me what's floating your boat right now. You never need an excuse to reach out to me. You rock for listening to this whole episode of the show. Thanks for giving me your time and attention and hopefully taking action on what you just heard, starting right now. It's time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zeslowski, creator of all things Value of Simple.